the Maker, where I used to train you." The old marshal trailed off awkwardly. "I will come as soon as my duties permit."
"Of course, your duties."
Veruz was already getting up, evidently keen to be on his way. Glockter held out his hand, making the old soldier pause for a moment. "You needn't worry, Lord Marshal, I am not contagious." Veruz gave it a limp shake, as though worried it might snap off. Then he mumbled his excuses and strode away, head held high. The dripping soldiers bowed and saluted as he walked past, somewhat embarrassed. Glockter stretched out his leg, wondering whether to get up. "And go where? The world will not end if I sit here a moment longer. There is no rush. No rush." Chapter 12. An Offer and a Gift.
"And forward!"
bellowed Marshal Veruz. Giselle lurched at him, toes curling round the edges of the beam, trying desperately to keep his balance, making a clumsy lunge or two just to give the impression of his heart being in it. 4 hours of training a day were taking their toll on him, and he felt beyond mere exhaustion. Veruz frowned and flicked Giselle's blunted steel aside, moving effortlessly along the beam as though it was a garden path.
"And back!"
Giselle stumbled back on his heels, left arm waving stupidly around him in an attempt to keep his balance. Everything above his knees was aching terribly from the effort. Below the knees, it was much, much worse. Veruz was over 60, but he showed no signs of fatigue. He wasn't even sweating as he danced forward down the beam, swishing his steels around. Giselle himself was gasping for air as he parried desperately with his left hand, badly off balance, his right foot fishing in space for the safety of the beam behind him.
"And forward!"
Giselle's calves were agony as he stumbled to change his direction and shove a blow at the infuriating old man, but Veruz did not move back. Instead, he ducked under the despairing cut and used the back of his arm to sweep Giselle's feet away. Giselle let out a howl as the courtyard turned over around him. His legs smacked painfully against the edge of the beam, then he sprawled on his face on the grass, chin thumping into the turf and making his teeth rattle. He rolled a short distance, then lay there on his back, gasping like a fish snatched suddenly from the water, leg throbbing where it had collided with the beam on his way down. He would have yet another ugly bruise in the morning.
"Awful, Giselle, awful!"
cried the old soldier as he sprang nimbly down onto the lawn.
"You teeter about the beam as though it were a tightrope!"
Giselle rolled over, cursing, and started to climb stiffly to his feet.
"It is a solid piece of oak, wide enough to get lost in."
The Lord Marshal illustrated his point by whacking at the beam with his short steel, making splinters fly.
"I thought you said forward," moaned Giselle.
Veruz's eyebrows went up sharply.
"Do you seriously suppose, Captain Luthar, that Bremer Dangorst gives his opponents reliable information as to his intentions?"
"Bremer Dangorst will be trying to beat me, you old shit. You are supposed to be helping me to beat him." That was what Giselle thought, but he knew better than to say it. He just shook his head dumbly.
"No, no, indeed he does not. He makes every effort to deceive and confuse his opponents, as all great swordsmen must."
The Lord Marshal paced up and down, shaking his head. Giselle considered again whether to give it all up. He was sick of falling into bed exhausted each night, at a time when he should have been just starting to get drunk. He was sick of waking up every morning, bruised and aching, to face another 4 interminable hours of running, beam, bar, forms. He was sick of being knocked on his ass by Major West. Most of all, he was sick of being bullied by this old fool.
"A depressing display, Captain, very depressing. I do believe you are actually getting worse."
Giselle would never win the contest. No one expected him to, himself least of all.
So why not give it up and go back to his cards and late nights? Wasn't that all he really wanted from life? But then what would mark him out from 1,000 other noble younger sons? He had decided long ago that he wanted to be something special. A Lord Marshal himself, perhaps, and then Lord Chamberlain. Something big and important, anyway. He wanted a big chair on the closed council, and to make big decisions. He wanted people to fawn and smile around him and hang on his every word. He wanted people to whisper, "There goes Lord Luther," as he swept past. Could he be happy being forever a richer, cleverer, better-looking version of Lieutenant Brint? Ugh! It was not to be thought of.
"We had a terribly long way to go, and not enough time to get there, not unless you change your attitude. Your sparring is lamentable, your stamina is still weak, and as for your balance, the less said about that, the better."
And what would everyone else think if he gave up? What would his father do? What would his brothers say? What about the other officers? He would look a coward. And then there was R.D. West. She seemed to have been much on his mind during the past couple of days. Would she lean so close to him if he didn't fence? Would she talk to him in such soft tones? Would she laugh at his jokes? Would she look up at him with those big dark eyes so he could almost feel her breath on his face?
"Are you listening, boy?"
thundered Veruz. Giselle felt a bit of his breath on his face, all right, and a deal of spit, too.
"Yes, sir. Sparring, lamentable, stamina weak."
Giselle swallowed nervously.
"Less said about balance, the better." "That's right. I am beginning to think, though I can hardly believe it after the trouble you have put me to, that your heart really isn't in this."
He glared into Giselle's eyes.
"What do you think, Major?"
There was no reply. West was slumped in his chair, arms folded, frowning grimly and staring into space.
"Major West!"
snapped the Lord Marshal. He looked up suddenly, as though he'd only just become aware of their presence.
"I'm sorry, sir. I had become distracted." "So I see."
Veruz sucked his teeth.
"It seems that nobody has been concentrating this morning."
It was a great relief that some of the old man's anger had been deflected elsewhere, but Giselle's happiness was not long-lived.
"Very well," snapped the old marshal. "If that's the way you want it, starting tomorrow, we will begin each session with a swim in the moat. A mile or two should do it."
Giselle squeezed his teeth together to keep from screaming.
"Cold water has a wonderful way of sharpening the senses, and perhaps we need to start a little earlier to catch you in your most receptive frame of mind. That means we begin at 5. In the meantime, Captain Luthar, I suggest that you consider whether you are here in order to win the contest or simply for the pleasure of my company."
And he turned on his heel and stalked off. Giselle waited until Veruz had left the courtyard before losing his temper, but once he was sure the old man was out of earshot, he flung his steels against the wall in a fury.
"Damn it!"
he shouted as the swords rattled to the ground.
"Shit!"
He looked around for something to kick that wouldn't hurt too much. His eye lighted on the leg of the beam, but he misjudged the kick badly and had to stifle the urge to grab his bruised foot and hop around like an idiot.
"Shit! Shit!"
he raged. West was disappointingly unimpressed. He got up, frowning, and made to follow Marshal Veruz.
"Where are you off to?" asked Giselle.
"Away," said West over his shoulder. "I've seen enough."
"What does that mean?"
West stopped and turned to face him.
"Amazing though it may seem, there are bigger problems in the world than this."
Giselle stood there open-mouthed as West stalked from the courtyard.
"Just who do you think you are?"
he shouted after him once he was sure he was gone.
"Shit, shit."
He considered giving the beam another kick, but thought better of it. Giselle was in a foul mood on his way back to his quarters, so he stayed away from the busier parts of the Agrient, sticking to the quieter lanes and gardens to the side of the Kingsway. He glowered down at his feet as he walked to further discourage any social encounter, but luck was not on his side.
Giselle!
It was Casper, out for a stroll with a yellow-haired girl in expensive clothes. They had a severe-looking middle-aged woman with them, no doubt the girl's governess or some such. They had stopped to admire some piece of minor sculpture in a little visited yard.
Giselle!
Casper shouted again, waving his hat above his head. There was no avoiding them. He plastered an unconvincing smile onto his face and stalked over. The pale girl smiled at him as he approached, but if he was meant to be charmed, he didn't feel it.
"Been fencing again, Luther?"
asked Casper pointlessly. Giselle was sweating and holding a pair of fencing steels. It was well known that he fenced every morning. You didn't need a fine mind to make the connection, which was fortunate, because Casper certainly didn't have one.
"Yes, how did you guess?"
Giselle hadn't meant to kill the conversation quite so dead, but he passed it off with a false chuckle, and the smiles of the ladies soon returned.
"Ha-ha-ha!"
laughed Casper, ever willing to be the butt of a joke.
"Giselle, may I introduce my cousin, the Lady Aristan Casper? This is my superior officer, Captain Luther."
So this was the famous cousin, one of the Union's richest heiresses and from an excellent family. Casper was always babbling about what a beauty she was, but to Giselle she seemed a pale, skinny, sickly-looking thing. She smiled weakly and offered out her limp white hand. He brushed it with the most perfunctory of kisses. "Charmed," he muttered without relish. "I must apologize for my appearance. I've just been fencing."
"Yes,"
she squeaked in a high, piping voice once she was sure he had finished speaking.
"I have heard you are a great fencer."
There was a pause while she groped for something to say, then her eyes lit up.
"Tell me, Captain, is fencing really very dangerous?"
What insipid drivel. "Oh, no, my lady. We only use blunted steels in the circle." He could have said more, but he was damned if he was going to make all the effort. He gave a thin smile, so did she. The conversation hovered over the abyss. Giselle was about to make his excuses, the subject of fencing evidently exhausted, but Aris cut him off by blundering on to another topic.
"And tell me, Captain, is there really likely to be a war in the North?"
Her voice had almost entirely faded away by the end of the sentence, but the chaperone stared on approvingly, no doubt delighted by the conversational skills of her charge. Spare us. "Well, it seems to me," Giselle began. The pale blue eyes of Lady Aris stared back at him expectantly. Blue eyes are absolute crap, he reflected. He wondered which subject she was more ignorant of, fencing or politics. "What do you think?" The chaperone's brow furrowed slightly. Lady Aris looked somewhat taken aback, blushing slightly as she groped for words.
"Well, that is to say, I'm sure that everything will turn out well."
"Thank the fates," thought Giselle. "We are saved." He had to get out of here. "Of course, everything will turn out well." He forced out one more smile. "It has been a real pleasure to make your acquaintance, but I'm afraid I'm on duty shortly, so I must leave you." He bowed with frosty formality. "Lieutenant Casper, Lady Aris." Casper clapped him on the arm as friendly as ever. His ignorant waif of a cousin smiled uncertainly. The governess frowned at him as he passed, but Giselle took no notice. He arrived at the Lord's Round just as the council members were returning from their lunchtime recess. He acknowledged the guards in the vestibule with a terse nod, then strode through the enormous doorway and down the central aisle. A straggling column of the greatest peers of the realm were hard on his heels, and the echoing space was full of shuffling footsteps, grumblings and whisperings, as Giselle made his way around the curved wall to his place behind the high table.
"Giselle, I was fencing."
It was Jallanhorm, here early for once and seizing on the opportunity to talk before the Lord Chamberlain arrived.
"I've had better mornings. Yourself?"
"Oh, I've been having a fine time. I met that cousin of Casper's, you know."
He searched for the name. Giselle sighed. "Lady Arris."
"Yes, that's it. Have you seen her?"
"I was lucky enough to run into them just now."
"Phew!" exclaimed Jallanhorn, pursing his lips. "Isn't she stunning?"
"Hmm." Giselle looked away, bored, and watched the robed and fur-trimmed worthies file slowly to their places. At least, he watched a sample of their least favourite sons and paid representatives. Very few of the magnates turned up in person for open council these days, not unless they had something significant to complain about. A lot of them didn't even bother to send someone in their place.
"I swear, one of the finest-looking girls I ever saw. I know Casper's always raving about her, but he didn't do her justice."
"Hmm." The councillors began to spread out, each man towards his own seat. The Lord's Round was designed like a theatre, the Union's leading noblemen sitting where the audience would be on a great half-circle of banked benches with an aisle down the centre. As in the theatre, some seats were better than others. The least important sat high up at the back, and the occupant's significance increased as you came forward. The front row was reserved for the heads of the very greatest families, or whoever they sent in their stead. Representatives from the south, from Degosca and Westport, were on the left, nearest to Giselle. On the far right were those from the north and west, from Angland and Starrickland. The bulk of the seating in between was for the old nobility of Middleland, the heart of the Union. The Union proper, as they would have seen it, as Giselle saw it too, for that matter.
"What poise, what grace!"
Jallanhorn was rhapsodizing.
"That wonderful fair hair, that milky white skin, those fantastic blue eyes."
"And all of that money."
"Well, yes, that too," smiled the big man. "Casper says his uncle is even richer than his father. Imagine that! And he is just the one child. She will inherit every mark of it, every mark."
Jallanhorn could scarcely contain his excitement.
"It's a lucky man that can bag her. What was her name again?"
"Arris," said Giselle sourly. The lords, or their proxies, had all shuffled and grumbled their way to their seats. It was a poor attendance. The benches were less than half full. That was about as full as it ever got. If the Lord's Round really had been a theatre, its owners would have been desperately in search of a new play.
"Arris, Arris."
Jallanhorn smacked his lips as though the name left a sweet taste.
"It's a lucky man that gets her."
"Yes, indeed, a lucky man. Providing he prefers cash to conversation, that is." Giselle thought he might have preferred to marry the governess. At least she had seemed to have a bit of backbone. The Lord Chamberlain had entered the hall now and was making his way towards the dais on which the high table stood, just about where the stage would have been, had the round been a theatre. He was followed by a gaggle of black-gowned secretaries and clerks, each man more or less encumbered with heavy books and sheaves of official-looking papers. With his crimson robes of state flapping behind him, Lord Hoff looked like nothing so much as a rare and stately gliding bird, pursued by a flock of troublesome crows.
"Here comes old Vinegar,"
whispered Jallanhorn as he sidled off to find his place on the other side of the table. Giselle put his hands behind his back and struck the usual pose, feet a little spread, chin high in the air. He swept an eye over the soldiers, regularly spaced around the curved wall, but each man was motionless and perfectly presented in full armour, as always. He took a deep breath and prepared himself for several hours of the most extreme tedium. The Lord Chamberlain threw himself into his tall chair and called for wine. The secretaries took their places around him, leaving a space in the centre for the King, who was absent as usual. Documents were rustled, great ledgers were heaved open, pens were sharpened and rattled in inkwells. The announcer walked to the end of the table and struck his staff of office on the floor for order. The whispering of the noblemen and their proxies, and that of the few attendees in the public gallery over their heads, gradually died down, leaving the vast chamber silent. The announcer puffed out his chest.
"I call this meeting,"
he said in slow and sonorous tones, as though he were giving the eulogy at a funeral,
"of the Open Council of the Union."
He gave an unnecessarily long and significant pause. The Lord Chamberlain's eyes flicked angrily towards him, but the announcer was not to be robbed of his moment of glory. He made everyone wait an instant longer before finishing,
"To order!"
"Thank you," said Hoff sourly. "I believe we were about to hear from the Lord Governor of Dagoska before we were interrupted by luncheon."
The scratching nibs of quills accompanied his voice as two clerks recorded his every word. The faint echoes of the pens merged with the echoes of his words in the great space above. An elderly man struggled to his feet in the front row close to Giselle, some papers clasped before him in shaky hands.
"The Open Council,"
droned the announcer, as ponderously as he dared,
"recognizes Rushdan Thule, accepted proxy of Sandan Worms, the Lord Governor of Dagoska."
"Thank you, sir."
Thule's cracking, wispy voice was absurdly small in the vast space. It barely carried as far as Giselle, and he was no more than 10 strides away.
"My lords,"
he began.
"Speak up!"
called someone from the back. There was a ripple of laughter. The old man cleared his throat and tried again.
"My lords, I come before you with an urgent message from the Lord Governor of Dagoska."
His voice had already faded to its original, barely audible level, each word accompanied by the persistent scratching of quills. Whispers began to emanate from the public gallery above, making it still harder to hear him.
"The threat posed to that great city by the Emperor of Gurkul increases with every passing day."
Vague sounds of disapproval began to float up from the far side of the room, where the representatives from Angland were seated, but the bulk of the councillors simply looked bored.
"Attacks on shipping, harassment of traders, and demonstrations beyond our walls have compelled the Lord Governor to send me..."
"Lochios!"
someone shouted. There was another wave of laughter, slightly louder this time.
"The city is built on but a narrow peninsula,"
persisted the old man, straining to make himself heard over the increasing background noise.
"Attached to a land controlled entirely by our bitter enemies, the Gurkish, and separated from Middleland by wide leagues of salt water. Our defences are not all they might be. The Lord Governor is sorely in need of more funds."
The mention of funds brought instant uproar from the assembly. Thule's mouth was still moving, but there was no chance of hearing him now. The Lord Chamberlain frowned and took a swallow from his goblet. The clerk furthest from Giselle had laid down his quill and was rubbing his eyes with his inky thumb and forefinger. The clerk closest had just finished writing a line. Giselle craned forward to see. It said simply, "Some shouting here." The announcer thumped his staff on the tiles with a look of great self-satisfaction. The hubbub eventually died down, but Thule had now been taken with a coughing fit. He tried to speak, but was unable, and eventually he waved his hand and sat down, very red in the face, while his neighbour thumped him on the back.
"If I may, Lord Chamberlain,"
shouted a fashionable young man in the front row on the other side of the hall, leaping to his feet. The scratching of the quills began once again.
"It seems to me..."
"The Open Council,"
cut in the announcer,
"recognizes Hersel Dan Mead, third son and accepted proxy of Fedor Dan Mead, the Lord Governor of Angland.
It seems to me,
continued the handsome young man, only slightly annoyed by this interruption, that our friends in the south are forever expecting a full-scale attack by the Emperor.
Dissenting voices were now raised on the other side of the room.
An attack which never materializes. Did we not defeat the Gurkish only a few short years ago, or does my memory deceive me?
The booing increased in volume.
This scaremongering represents an unacceptable drain on the Union's resources.
He was shouting to be heard.
In Angland, we have many miles of border and too few soldiers, while the threat from Bethod and his Northmen is very real. If anyone is in need of funds...
The shouting was instantly redoubled. Cries of,
"Hear, hear!" "Nonsense!"
"True!"
and "Lies!"
could be vaguely made out over the hubbub. Several of the representatives were on their feet shouting. Some vigorously nodded their agreement. Some violently shook their heads in dissent. Others yawned and stared around. Giselle could see one fellow, near to the back in the center, who was almost certainly asleep, and in imminent danger of slumping into his neighbor's lap. He allowed his eyes to wander up over the faces ranged around the rail of the public gallery. He felt a strange tugging in his chest. R.D. West was up there, looking straight down at him. As their eyes met, she smiled and waved. He was smiling himself, with his arm halfway up to wave, when he remembered where he was. He pushed his arm behind his back and looked around nervously, but was relieved to find that no one important had noticed his mistake. The smile would not quite leave his face, though.
"My lords!"
roared the Lord Chamberlain, smashing his empty goblet down on the high table. He had the loudest voice Giselle had ever heard. Even Marshal Verus could have learned a thing or two about shouting from Hoff. The sleeping man near the back started up, sniffing and blinking. The noise died away almost immediately. Those representatives left standing looked around guiltily, like naughty children called to account, and gradually sat down. The whispers from the public gallery went still. Order was restored.
"My lords, I can assure you the king has no more serious concern than the safety of his subjects, no matter where they are. The Union does not permit aggression against its people or property."
Hoff punctuated each comment by smashing his fist down in front of him.
"From the Emperor of Gurkle? From these savages in the north? Or from anyone else?"
He struck the table so hard on this last comment that ink splashed from a well and ran all over one of the clerk's carefully prepared documents. Calls of agreement and support greeted the Lord Chamberlain's patriotic display.
"As for the specific circumstance of Dagoska..."
Thule looked up hopefully, chest still shaking with suppressed coughs.
"Is that city not possessed of some of the most powerful and extensive defences in the world? Did it not resist a siege by the Gurkish less than a decade ago, for over a year? What has become of the walls, sir? The walls?"
The great room fell quiet as everyone strained to hear the reply.
"Lord Chamberlain,"
wheezed Thule, his voice nearly drowned out as one of the clerks turned the crackling page of his huge book and began scratching on the next.
"The defences have fallen into poor repair, and we lack the soldiers to keep them properly manned. The Emperor is not ignorant of this,"
he whispered, all but inaudible.
"I beg of you..."
He dissolved into another fit of coughing and dropped into his seat, accompanied by some light jeering from the Angland delegation. Hoff frowned even more deeply.
"It was my understanding that the defences of the city were to be maintained by monies raised locally and by trade levies upon the Honourable Guild of Spicers, who have operated in Dagoska under an exclusive and highly profitable licence these past 7 years. If resources cannot be found even to maintain the walls," and he swept the assembly with a dark eye,
Perhaps it is time that this license was put out to tender.
There was a volley of angry mutterings around the public gallery.
In any case, the Crown can spare no extra monies at present.
Jeers of dissatisfaction came from the Dagoska side of the room, hoots of agreement from the Angland side.
As for the specific circumstance of Angland, thundered the Lord Chamberlain, turning towards Mead, I believe we may shortly hear some good news for you to take back to your father, the Lord Governor.
A cloud of excited whisperings rose up into the gilded dome above. The handsome young man looked pleasantly surprised, as well he might. It was rare indeed that anyone took good news away from the Open Council, or news of any kind for that matter. Thule had got control of his lungs once more, and he opened his mouth to speak, but he was interrupted by a great beating on the huge door behind the high table. The lords looked up, surprised, expectant. The Lord Chamberlain smiled, in the manner of a magician who has just pulled off an exceptionally difficult trick. He signalled to the guards. The heavy iron bolts were drawn back, and the great inlaid doors creaked slowly open. 8 knights of the body, encased in glittering armour, faceless behind high polished helmets, resplendent in purple cloaks marked on the back with a golden sun, stomped in unison down the steps and took their places to either side of the high table. They were closely followed by 4 trumpeters, who stepped smartly forward, raising their shining instruments to their lips, and blew an ear-splitting fanfare. Giselle gritted his rattling teeth and narrowed his eyes, but eventually the ringing echoes faded. The Lord Chamberlain turned angrily toward the announcer, who was staring at the new arrivals with his mouth open.
"Well?"
hissed Hoff. The announcer jumped to life.
"Ah, yes, of course. My lords and ladies, I have the great honour to present..."
He paused and took a huge breath.
"His Imperial Highness, the King of Angland, of Starrickland, and of Middleland, the Protector of Westport and of Dagoska, His August Majesty, Guslav V, High King of the Union."
There was a great rustling noise as every man and woman in the hall shifted from their seats and down onto one knee. The royal palanquin processed slowly through the doors, carried on the shoulders of 6 more faceless knights. The king was sitting in a gilded chair on top, propped up on rich cushions and swaying gently from side to side. He was staring about him with the startled expression of a man who went to sleep drunk and has woken up in an unfamiliar room. He looked awful, enormously fat, lolling like a great hill swathed in fur and red silk, head squashed into his shoulders by the weight of the great sparkling crown. His eyes were glassy and bulging, with huge dark bags hanging beneath, and the pink point of his tongue kept flicking nervously over his pale lips. He had great low jowls and a roll of fat around his neck. In fact, his whole face gave the appearance of having slightly melted and started to run down off his skull. Such was the High King of the Union, but Giselle bowed his head a little lower as the palanquin approached just the same.
"No,"
muttered His August Majesty, as though he had forgotten something.
"Please rise."
The rustling noise filled the hall again as everybody rose and returned to their seats. The king turned toward Hoff, brow deeply furrowed, and Giselle heard him say,
"Why am I here?"
"The Northmen, Your Majesty."
"Oh, yes."
The king's eyes lit up. He paused.
"What about them?"
But the Lord Chamberlain was saved from replying by the opening of the doors on the opposite side of the hall, the ones through which Giselle had first entered. 2 strange men strode through and advanced down the aisle. One was a grizzled old warrior with a scar and a blind eye, carrying a flat wooden box. The other was cloaked and hooded, every feature hidden, and so big that he made the whole hall seem out of proportion.
The benches, the tables, even the guards, all suddenly looked like small versions designed for the use of children. As he passed, a couple of the representatives closest to the aisle cringed and shuffled away. Giselle frowned to himself. This hooded giant did not have the look of good news, whatever Lord Hoff might say. Angry and suspicious mutterings filled the echoing dome as the two Northmen took their places on the tiled floor before the high table.
"Your Majesty,"
said the announcer, bowing so ridiculously low that he had to support himself with his staff.
"The Open Council recognizes Fenris the Feared, the envoy of Bethod, King of the Northmen, and his translator, White Eye Hansel."
The king was staring off happily towards one of the great windows in the curved wall, utterly oblivious, perhaps admiring the way the light shone through the beautiful stained glass. But he looked suddenly round, jowls vibrating, as the old half-blind warrior addressed him.
"Your Majesty, I bring brotherly greetings from my master Bethod, King of the Northmen."
The round had fallen very still, and the clerk's scratching nibs seemed absurdly loud. The old warrior nodded at the great hooded shape beside him with an awkward smile.
"Fenris the Feared brings an offer from Bethod to yourself, from king to king, from the north to the Union. An offer and a gift."
And he raised the wooden box. The Lord Chamberlain gave a self-satisfied smirk.
"Speak your offer first."
"It is an offer of peace, an endless peace between our two great nations."
White Eye bowed again. His manners were impeccable, Giselle had to admit. Not what one would expect from savages of the cold and distant north. His goodly speech would almost have been enough to put the room at ease, had it not been for the hooded man beside him, looming like a dark shadow. The king's face twitched into a weak smile at this mention of peace, however.
"Good," he muttered. "Excellent. Peace. Capital. Peace is good."
"He asks but one small thing in return," said White Eye.
The Lord Chamberlain's face had turned suddenly dour, but it was too late.
"He has but to name it,"
said the king, smiling indulgently. The hooded man stepped forward.
"Angland," he hissed.
There was a moment of stillness, then the hall exploded with noise. There was a gale of disbelieving laughter from the public gallery. Mead was on his feet, red-faced and screaming. Thule totted up from his bench, then fell back coughing. Angry bellows were joined by hoots of derision. The king was staring about him with all the dignity of a startled rabbit. Giselle's eyes were fixed on the hooded man. He saw a great hand slip out from his sleeve and reach for the clasp on his cloak. He blinked in surprise. Was the hand blue, or was it just a trick of the light through the stained glass? The cloak dropped to the floor. Giselle swallowed, his heart thumping loud in his ears. It was like staring at a terrible wound. The more he was revolted, the less he could look away. The laughter died, the shouting died, the great space became terribly still once more. Fenris the Feared seemed larger yet without his cloak, towering over his cringing translator. Without any doubt, he was the biggest man that Giselle had ever seen, if man he was. His face was in constant, twisted, sneering motion. His bulging eyes twitched and blinked as they stared crazily around at the assembly. His thin lips smiled and grimaced and frowned by turns, never still. But all this seemed ordinary by comparison with his strangest feature. His whole left side, from head to toe, was covered in writing. Crabby runes were scrawled across the left half of his shaven head, across his eyelid, his lips, his scalp, his ear. His huge left arm was tattooed blue with tiny writing from bulging shoulder to the tips of his long fingers. Even his bare left foot was covered in strange letters. An enormous, inhuman, painted monster stood at the very heart of the Union's government. Jezal's jaw hung open. Around the high table, there were 14 knights of the body, each man a hard-trained fighter of good blood. There were perhaps 40 guardsmen of Jezal's own company around the walls, each one a seasoned veteran. They outnumbered these two Northmen more than 20 to 1, and were well armed with the best steel the king's armouries could provide. Fenris the Feared carried no weapon. For all his size and strangeness, he should have been no threat to them. But Jezal did not feel safe. He felt alone, weak, helpless, and terribly afraid. His skin was tingling, his mouth was dry. He felt a sudden urge to run and hide and never come out again. And this strange effect was not limited to him, or even to those around the high table. Angry laughs turned to shocked gurgles as the painted monster turned slowly around in the center of the circular floor, flickering eyes running over the crowd. Meade shrank back onto his bench, anger all leached out of him. A couple of worthies on the front row actually scrambled over the backs of their benches and into the row behind. Others looked away or covered their faces with their hands. One of the soldiers dropped his spear, and it clattered loudly to the floor. Fenris the Feared turned slowly to the high table, raising his great tattooed fist, opening his chasm of a mouth, a hideous spasm running over his face.
"England!"
he screamed, louder and more terrible by far than the Lord Chamberlain had ever been. The echoes of his voice bounced off the domed ceiling high above, resounded from the curved walls, filling the great space with piercing sound. One of the knights of the body stumbled back and slipped, his armored leg clanking against the edge of the high table. The king shrank back and covered his face with his hand, one terrified eye staring out from between his fingers, crown teetering on his head. The quill of one of the clerks dropped from his nerveless fingers. The hand of the other moved across the paper by habit, while his mouth fell open, scrawling a messy word diagonally through the neat lines of script above. "England." The Lord Chamberlain's face had turned waxy pale. He reached slowly for his goblet, raised it to his lips. It was empty. He placed it carefully back down on the table, but his hand was trembling, and the bass rattled on the wood. He paused for a moment, breathing heavily through his nose.
"Plainly, this offer is not acceptable."
"That is unfortunate," said White-Eye Hansel. "But there is still the gift."
Every eye turned towards him.
"In the North we have a tradition. On occasion, when there is bad blood between two clans, when there is the threat of war, champions come forward from each side to fight for all their people, so that the issue might be decided with only one death."
He slowly opened the lid of the wooden box. There was a long knife inside, blade polished mirror bright.
"His greatness Bethod sends the Feared, not only as his envoy, but as his champion. He will fight for Angland, if any here will face him, and spare you a war you will not win."
He held the box up to the painted monster.
"This is my master's gift to you, and there could be none richer. Your lives."
Fenris's right hand darted out and snatched the knife from the box. He raised it high, blade flashing in the colored light from the great windows. The knights should have jumped forward. Jezal should have drawn his sword. All should have rushed to the defense of the king. But nobody moved. Every mouth was agape. Every eye fastened on that glinting tooth of steel. The blade flashed down. Its point drove easily through skin and flesh until it was buried right to the hilt. The point emerged, dripping blood from the underside of Fenris's own tattooed left arm. His face twitched, but no more than usual. The blade moved grotesquely as he stretched out his fingers, raised his left arm high for all to see. The drops of blood made a steady patter on the floor of the Lord's Round.
"Who will fight me?"
he screamed, great cords of sinew bulging from his neck. His voice was almost painful to the ear. Utter silence. The announcer, who was closest to the feared and already on his knees, swooned and collapsed on his face. Fenris turned his goggling eyes on the biggest knight before the table, a full head shorter than he was.
"You?"
he hissed. The unfortunate man's foot scraped on the floor as he backed away, no doubt wishing he had been born a dwarf. A puddle of dark blood had spread across the floor beneath Fenris's elbow.
"You!"
he snarled at Fedor Danmead. The young man turned slightly grey, teeth rattling together, no doubt wishing he was someone else's son. Those blinking eyes swept across the ashen faces on the high table. Giselle's throat constricted as Fenris's eyes met his.
"You?"
"Well, I would, but I'm terribly busy this afternoon. Perhaps tomorrow?"
The voice hardly sounded like his own. He certainly hadn't meant to say any such thing. But who else's could it be? The words floated confidently, breezily up towards the gilded dome above. There was scattered laughter, a shout of bravo from somewhere at the back, but the eyes of the fear did not leave Giselle's for an instant. He waited for the sounds to die, then his mouth twisted into a hideous leer.
"Tomorrow, then," he whispered.
Giselle's guts gave a sudden, painful shift. The seriousness of the situation pressed itself upon him like a ton of rocks.
"Him? Fight that?"
"No!"
It was the Lord Chamberlain. He was still pale, but his voice had regained much of its vigour. Giselle took heart and fought manfully for control of his bowels.
"No!"
barked Hoff again.
"There will be no duel here. There is no issue to decide. Angland is a part of the Union by ancient law."
White-Eye Hansel chuckled softly.
"Ancient law? Angland is part of the North. 200 years ago, there were Northmen there living free. You wanted iron, so you crossed the sea and slaughtered them and stole their land. It must be, then, that most ancient of laws, that the strong take what they wish from the weak."
His eyes narrowed.
"We have that law also."
Fenris the Feared ripped the knife from his arm. A few last drops of blood spattered onto the tiles, but that was all. There was no wound on the tattooed flesh, no mark at all. The knife clattered onto the tiles and lay there in the pool of blood at his feet. Fenris swept the assembly with his bulging, blinking, crazy eyes one last time. Then he turned and strode across the floor and up the aisle, lords and proxies scrambling away down their benches as he approached. White-Eye Hansel bowed low.
"Perhaps the time will come when you wish that you had accepted our offer, or our gift. You will hear from us,"
he said quietly. Then he held up three fingers to the Lord Chamberlain.
"When it is time, we will send three signs."
"Send 300, if you wish," barked Hoff. "But this pantomime is over."
White-Eye Hansel nodded pleasantly.
"You will hear from us."
And he turned and followed Fenris the Feared out of the Lord's Round. The great doors clapped shut. The quill of the nearest clerk scratched weakly against the paper. "You will hear from us." Hersel Danmead turned towards the Lord Chamberlain, jaw locked tight, handsome features contorted with fury.
"And this is the good news you would have me convey to my father?" he screamed.
The open council erupted. Bellowing, shouting, abuse directed toward anyone and everyone, chaos of the worst kind. Hoff jumped up, chair toppling over behind him, mouthing angry words, but even he was drowned out by the uproar. Mead turned his back on him and stormed out. Other delegates from the Angland side of the room rose grimly and followed the son of their Lord Governor. Hoff stared after them, livid with anger, mouth working silently. Giselle watched the king slowly take his hand from his face and lean down towards his Lord Chamberlain.
"When are the Northmen getting here?" he whispered.
Chapter 13. The King of the Northmen. Logan breathed in deep, enjoying the unfamiliar feel of the cool breeze on his fresh-shaved jaw, and took in the view. It was the beginning of a clear day. The dawn mist was almost gone, and from the balcony outside Logan's room, high up on the side of one of the towers of the library, you could see for miles. The great valley was spread out before him, split into stark layers. On top was the grey and puffy white of the cloudy sky. Then there was the ragged line of black crags that ringed the lake, and the dim brown suggestion of others beyond. Next came the dark green of the wooded slopes, then the thin, curving line of grey shingle on the beach. All was repeated in the still mirror of the lake below, another shadowy world upside down beneath his own. Logan looked down at his hands, fingers spread out on the weathered stone of the parapet. There was no dirt, no dried blood under his cracked fingernails. They looked pale, soft, pinkish, strange. Even the scabs and scrapes on his knuckles were mostly healed. It was so long since Logan had been clean that he'd forgotten what it felt like. His new clothes were coarse against his skin, robbed of its usual covering of dirt and grease and dry sweat. Looking out at the still lake, clean and well-fed, he felt a different man. For a moment, he wondered how this new Logan might turn out, but the bare stone of the parapet stared back at him where his missing finger used to be. That could never heal. He was nine fingers still, the bloody nine, and always would be, unless he lost any more fingers. He did smell better, though, that had to be admitted.
"Did you sleep well, Master Nine Fingers?"
Wells was in the doorway, peering out onto the balcony.
"Like a baby."
Logan didn't have the heart to tell the old servant that he'd slept outside. The first night he'd tried the bed, rolling and wriggling, unable to come to terms with the strange comfort of a mattress and the unfamiliar warmth of blankets. Next he'd tried the floor. That had been an improvement. But the air had still seemed close, flat, stale. The ceiling had hung over him, seeming to creep ever lower, threatening to crush him with the weight of stone above. It was only when he'd laid down on the hard flags of the balcony, with his old coat spread over him, and just the clouds and the stars above, that sleep had come. Some habits are hard to break.
"You have a visitor," said Wells.
"Me?" Malachus Quai's head appeared round the doorframe. His eyes were a little less sunken, the bags underneath them a little less dark. There was some colour to his skin, and some flesh on his bones. He no longer looked like a corpse, just gaunt and sick, as he had done when Logan first met him. He guessed that was about as healthy as Quai ever looked.
"Ah!" laughed Logan. "You survived!"
The apprentice gave a series of tired nods as he shambled across the room. He was swathed in a thick blanket which trailed on the floor and made it difficult for him to walk properly. He shuffled out of the door to the balcony and stood there, sniffing and blinking in the chill morning air. Logan was more pleased to see him than he'd expected. He clapped him on the back like an old friend, perhaps a little too warmly. The apprentice stumbled, blanket tangled round his feet, and would have fallen if Logan hadn't put out an arm to steady him.
"Still not quite in fighting shape,"
muttered Kwai with a weak grin.
"You look a deal better than when I last saw you."
"So do you. You lost the beard, I see. And the smell, too. A few less scars and you'd look almost civilized."
Logan held his hands up.
"Anything but that."
Wells ducked through the doorway into the bright morning light. He had a roll of cloth and a knife in his hand.
"Could I see your arm, Master Nine Fingers?"
Logan had almost forgotten about the cut. There was no new blood on the bandage, and when he unwound it, there was a long red-brown scab underneath, running almost all the way from wrist to elbow, surrounded by fresh pink skin. It hardly hurt any more, just itched. It crossed two other older scars. One, a jagged grey effort near his wrist, he thought he might have got in the duel with Three Trees all those years ago. Logan grimaced as he remembered the battering they'd given each other. The second scar, fainter, higher up, he wasn't sure about. Could have come from anywhere. Wells bent down and tested the flesh round the wound, while Kwai peered cautiously over his shoulder.
"It's mending well. You're a fast healer.
Lots of practice."
Wells looked up at Logan's face, where the cut on his forehead had already faded to one more pink line.
"I can see. Would it be foolish to advise you to avoid sharp objects in the future?"
Logan laughed.
"Believe it or not, I always did my best to avoid them in the past, but they seem to seek me out despite my efforts."
"Well,"
said the old servant, cutting off a fresh length of cloth and winding it carefully around Logan's forearm,
"I hope this is the last bandage you ever need."
"So do I," said Logan, flexing his fingers. "So do I." But he didn't think it would be.
"Breakfast will be ready soon."
And Wells left the two of them alone on the balcony. They stood there in silence for a moment, then the wind blew up cold from the valley. Kwai shivered and pulled his blanket tight around him.
"Out there, by the lake, you could have left me. I would have left me."
Logan frowned. Time was, he'd have done it and never given it a second thought. But things change.
"I've left a lot of people in my time. Reckon I'm sick of that feeling."
The apprentice pursed his lips and looked out at the valley, the woods, the distant mountains.
"I never saw a man killed before."
"You're lucky."
"You've seen a lot of death, then?"
Logan winced. In his youth, he would have loved to answer that very question. He could have bragged and boasted and listed the actions he'd been in, the named men he'd killed. He couldn't say now when the pride had dried up. It had happened slowly. As the wars became bloodier, as the causes became excuses, as the friends went back to the mud, one by one. Logan rubbed at his ear, felt the big notch that Tul Duru's sword had made long ago. He could have stayed silent, but for some reason he felt the need to be honest. "I've fought in 3 campaigns," he began, "in 7 pitched battles, in countless raids and skirmishes and desperate defenses and bloody actions of every kind. I've fought in the driving snow, the blasting wind, the middle of the night. I've been fighting all my life, one enemy or another, one friend or another. I've known little else. I've seen men killed for a word, for a look, for nothing at all. A woman tried to stab me once for killing her husband, and I threw her down a well. And that's far from the worst of it. Life used to be as cheap as dirt to me, cheaper. I've fought 10 single combats, and I won them all. But I fought on the wrong side and for all the wrong reasons. I've been ruthless and brutal and a coward. I've stabbed men in the back, burned them, drowned them, crushed them with rocks, killed them asleep, unarmed or running away. I've run away myself more than once. pissed myself with fear. I've begged for my life. I've been wounded often and badly, and screamed and cried like a baby whose mother took her tit away. I've no doubt the world would be a better place if I'd been killed years ago. But I haven't been.